It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wakebright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
Basically, what a hospital has to do now, a nonprofit hospital under federal law, they either have to charge the uninsured patient the lowest scheduled rate for the hospital, which will typically be the Medicaid rate, which is very, very low, or if they go through the proper procedures, they can take the three lowest insurance rates for that hospital, average them, and that's the maximum charge that can be imposed on an uninsured patient.
Peyton Whiteley, advocacy coordinator with Legal Services of Northern Virginia, reveals the new and surprising defenses to hospital debt collection if you're uninsured or not fully insured, get hospital care, and receive a hospital bill or lawsuit. And during this week's News You Can Use, we talk about efforts to spur a statewide Virginia Housing Trust Fund and Richmond's stalled version of our own Affordable Housing Trust Fund. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 137, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. The Virginia Housing Coalition, or VHC, is coordinating a statewide effort to create a Virginia Housing Trust Fund during the 2012 General Assembly session. The fund would provide financial support for affordable housing statewide. The research firm Chimura Economics and Analytics has produced a report, The Economic Impact of a Housing Trust Fund on the Virginia Economy, describing the impact of a trust fund on jobs and the economy, which will be released in Richmond on September 8. Housing advocates plan to use this report, along with additional research that speaks to unmet housing needs, to advocate for the Virginia Housing Trust Fund. In all, 39 states have adopted housing trust funds. In addition, counties and cities have housing trust funds which support affordable housing, including Fairfax County, Arlington County, the City of Alexandria, and the City of Charlottesville. The City of Richmond has had an Affordable Housing Trust Fund since 2008, but its oversight board never has been fully appointed, never has met, and no money has gone into the fund, despite the public pledges of a majority of the City Council on April 14, 2011, to appoint the board by July 1 and obtain funding recommendations by November 1. In other news, the U.S. Department of Agriculture has issued a proposed regulation to help stem the practice of water dumping and other program abuses under the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, formerly food stamps, by expanding the definition of trafficking. Water dumping is buying a beverage that requires a container deposit and immediately dumping out the contents in order to return the container and receive the deposit back in cash. The proposed rule expands the definition of trafficking to include selling food purchased with SNAP benefits and would make this a program violation that could lead to disqualification. But the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities is concerned that the proposed language is not specific enough to target the intended abuses. The definition of trafficking could be interpreted to include innocent behavior by SNAP recipients, such as buying cupcakes with SNAP benefits and then selling the cupcakes at the school bake sale. In addition, there is no language that explains how to prove that the trafficked food product was purchased with SNAP benefits as opposed to the SNAP household's cash. For more information, go to www.cbpp.org. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's case that changed the Commonwealth is Petachenko versus Petachenko. After 15 years of marriage, Mary Petachenko moved out of the marital home and filed for a divorce, claiming constructive desertion. Her husband filed a cross bill seeking a divorce on the grounds of desertion. During the next 2 years, while the divorce was pending, they attended marriage counseling and engaged in sexual intercourse, either one or two times. Due to this, the Virginia Beach Circuit Court dismissed the divorce, believing the parties had reconciled. However, the Supreme Court of Virginia found that no reconciliation had occurred and reversed. The court noted that a reconciliation consists of more than sexual relations and also includes the continuing condition of living together and carrying out the mutual responsibilities of a marriage relationship. Because the Petachenkos had not done this, they had not reconciled. This has been the law ever since. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault at Petachenko versus Petachenko is this week's case that changed the Commonwealth.
We're here at Central Virginia Legal Aid Society, and we're speaking with Peyton Whiteley, who is the Advocacy Coordinator for Legal Services of Northern Virginia, and we're going to be talking about hospital debt collection defenses today. Welcome to the show, Peyton.
Glad to be here, Marty.
Now, Peyton, most people listening would probably be of the belief that if they are uninsured, and they go to a hospital, and they get treatment, and they get a bill afterwards that basically they owe what is billed, and they have to pay it, or at least that's going to be a debt. You're here to disabuse us of that notion. Tell us why that's not true.
I'd be glad to, Marty, and actually the general proposition that I'll start with is the person in that scenario who has been treated in a hospital who lacked insurance, even irrespective of income, almost certainly does not owe the bill, or at least does not owe the entirety of the bill that they're going to receive. So what I'd like to do is to run through a few simple things that's important for people to know. And this will, unfortunately, you know, nothing is simple. There's no uniformity in the Commonwealth. I come from Northern Virginia, where we have several large hospital systems, and in fact, the procedures, the policies are a little different for each hospital and each hospital system. But I'm going to try to focus on the law that would be applicable down here in the Richmond area.
Okay, please go ahead.
Okay. Well, first, it may be a little bit helpful to know one big change in law that has had some impact on collection and collection practices, and that starts in 2009, Virginia made a substantial change in Virginia law on this topic. Actually, what the legislature did was they eliminated a program that used to be available to assist some people who did not meet the requirements for the federal Medicaid program. Some low-income people used to get help with hospital bills or avoid payment of hospital bills through what was called the State and Local Hospitalization Program, which the legislature, in its wisdom, abolished in 2009, I believe, to save money.
And they replaced that with this posting of charity care policies, which you're going to talk about?
Yes. And actually, there's several significant things, and it's interesting, this is part of what makes Virginia different from other states. So what the legislature did in 2009 when they eliminated the program, they first, and I'll get to posting, but first they required hospitals in the state, not just the nonprofits, but any for-profit hospitals, to have financial assistance or charity care policies. Now, many hospitals, in fact, did, but they were very informal. And I like to say, back in the 5 or so years ago, don't ask, don't tell was the general approach to finding out about hospitals' assistance policies. So first, that required hospitals to have a policy. It didn't mandate the requirements of the policy. So there are different terms on who is eligible, and you'll find a lot of disparities around the state. But every hospital has to have a financial assistance policy. And the key elements of the state law were, first of all, for the high-tech age, each hospital must post on its website its financial assistance policy. In addition to that, it must post and make available in the hospital information about its financial assistance policy, and it must take essentially reasonable steps to inform the patients who come in for treatment of the existence of its financial assistance policy.
And what steps do they have to take to inform their patients of these policies?
The legislation is clearest about posting it on their website and posting it in the hospital. After that, it's less than clear, which is helpful as a defense attorney in these cases because, of course, the position that I take is they must do everything that's reasonable. And when I litigate a case, if they fail to interview someone who is in the hospital, typically has filled out on the admission form that they do not have insurance, I believe there should at least be an interview. Someone on staff with the hospital must speak with a patient who's informed the hospital that they lack insurance coverage in order to advise them about the financial assistance policy. So the legislation is less than clear. After posting the policy on the website and after posting it in the hospital in conspicuous places, there must be some effort to inform the patients, but that's not clearly defined.
So I gather your view is that once the hospital has knowledge that a patient is uninsured, the burden shifts to the hospital to make some further inquiry, and if they don't, the patient may have a defense to the hospital collection debt. How do you find that argument works in court? What happens?
Actually, it works quite well in tandem with several other things that I'll relate to you and your audience that horrifies hospital plaintiff's attorneys that goes hand in hand. Actually, federal law for a long time has required hospitals to affirmatively assist uninsured patients to apply for the Medicaid program. There's actually an old New York decision from 1972, Mount Sinai Hospital versus Corngay, that collection attorneys, and that is hospital attorneys, know about, that interpreted federal law and the basis of that law, but you'll see how it ties in with informing less than knowledgeable patients. What the New York decision interpreting federal law said, that there are tight time deadlines on applying for the Medicaid program. That is expertise a hospital has, that it will know the time requirements. It'll know that it has many patients who may not be very well educated, may not speak English, who may need assistance. And since it is in their interest to collect any money that may be due, in that case through the Medicaid program, that they have an affirmative duty to assist any potentially eligible patients to make application for the Medicaid program. Now, I'll give you one of my tips that I think people in your audience might find helpful, and this is a vulnerable point. This is going to be true of most hospitals. Most people who go into a hospital don't pay careful attention to the paperwork, and there is something that's extremely helpful for people without insurance if they just read the paperwork. There's a clause in most admission agreements. It's a power of attorney. And basically what hospitals have done, because they don't want to depend upon even their people with insurance to promptly and properly make application for insurance coverage. Most everyone who goes into a hospital for treatment who signs a form, one of the clauses they've signed is they have authorized the hospital to make application for any coverage with the cost of their treatment that may exist. Now, I know what the hospitals think that means, which is they'll apply for Medicare or Blue Cross Blue Shield or Travelers or one of those better paying policies. But the way I interpret it, and this is successfully in court, is that includes applying for Medicaid, that includes applying for the hospital's own charity care program, and if they fail to, that's a basis to defend the bill. There's a companion principle of Virginia law that says that any ambiguity in a contract is construed against the maker of the contract. So I argue the hospital wrote up this contract. They wrote up the authorization giving them the power to apply on behalf of the patient for any coverage that may exist, and that includes, based on a contract principle, the hospital has to apply to its own financial assistance program for someone who may be eligible.
And I suppose you also would use that with the doctrine of a party that potentially suffers a financial loss has to minimize or mitigate their damages.
Mitigation of damages would be another contract principle, absolutely, that applies. So just under straight traditional contract law in Virginia, and I have found even fairly traditional small-c conservative judges readily accept that principle. They understand that the party with the expertise when it comes to claims, making claims, knowing what coverage is available are the hospital personnel and staff. Typically, the people coming into the hospital, particularly those without insurance, lack that knowledge or expertise, so that it is a duty of the hospital. And I've found the duty by contract very often is clearer and easier to enforce than even the 2009 change in legislation that I referred to.
Okay, so we've got traditional contract principles. We've got Virginia's 2009 statute. And now I gather the Affordable Care Act, the federal health care reform, also gives greater ammunition. What does that do for patients?
A number of things. Perhaps the most significant thing and that would relate to uninsured patients is the federal law. And let me stop for a moment. Like a lot of things, including a bill that's 2,000 pages long, there's some complexity, but I'll try to simplify without oversimplifying. But basically, the federal law applies to nonprofit hospitals, not for-profit hospitals. So a for-profit hospital, your defenses would come from state law. But if it's a nonprofit hospital, there are a number of developments, but there's one most significant development in federal law, and that is to limit the amount that can be billed to an uninsured patient. Basically, the way the law has worked prior to 2011, if someone lacked insurance, whether they were rich or poor, the hospital would charge them the highest rates they charge for services in the hospital. Essentially, the governmental insurance programs, Medicare, Medicaid, limited the amount that would have to be paid. Say, Blue Cross Blue Shield and other private insurance companies negotiated lower payments. The only party that had no one negotiating on their behalf was the uninsured patient. So that's when you hear, you know, the $500 aspirin, the huge, enormous costs, which frankly a hospital was trying to recover. The bills would typically, we would find, would be 3 to 4 times what were being billed other patients with insurance would be the uninsured patient, which would mean, for example, a Medicaid patient who the state might pay $1,000 for the exact same procedure billed to an uninsured patient would typically be $8,000 to $10,000. So there's a very substantial higher bill that was charged a uninsured patient. And I'll put to one side for a moment, and we came up with a number of strategies to challenge that. But the good news is under federal law, basically what a hospital has to do now, a nonprofit hospital under federal law, they either have to charge the uninsured patient the lowest scheduled rate for the hospital, which will typically be the Medicaid rate, which is very, very low, or if they go through the proper procedures, they can take the 3 lowest insurance rates for that hospital, average them, and that's the maximum charge that can be imposed on an uninsured patient.
So if the hospital is billing and even suing an uninsured patient and they just produce a bill, I gather you're saying that's essentially meaningless because they have to come up before the judge with the comparable charges that would be paid by either Medicaid or the three lowest in order to prove that they are complying with federal law.
Absolutely. That's part of what we call in law, to use a Latin term like we attorneys like to, their prima facie case, their basic case to recover money. If they're forced to their proof, that is, by patients not showing up in court, what I want to come back and tell people that's the most important thing, is they have to show that they are charging a legally proper, reasonable rate, and federal law has now put a cap on that, a maximum on the charge. And in all probability, the way that it's set up under federal law, the most advantageous rate other than a sliding fee scale, and I'll come back to a rate under the hospital's financial assistance or charity care program, is going to be this provision of federal law, the Medicaid rate or the averaged rate.
All right, so what is the most important thing for a patient who is sued by a hospital, especially a nonprofit hospital, to do?
First of all, if they've been sued, that means probably some things have gone wrong. What the hospital also has to do is to, in their billing statements, every billing statement must include information about their financial assistance program. Now, I know most people don't bother to read the bills and literature they're sent, but perhaps the most important thing to tell people, I mentioned before, the admission agreement when you go into the hospital really is important. But beyond that, you should receive one or more bills before you're sued, and the bills should provide clear information about the financial assistance program. I think that is, I understand around the Commonwealth, that is a problem. It's even a problem in Northern Virginia that we're working this summer with the hospital system to resolve issues that has to do with them bearing or putting in confusing language the information about the availability of their charity care or financial assistance. So anyone who, before they were sued, has gotten a bill from a hospital should have a reasonably clear statement of what to do and the existence of the financial assistance program so that they can make application for that. And that's going to be a defense to the collection action if the proper notice has not been given by the hospital. It most likely, even though the case is being litigated in court, is not too late typically to file a claim for financial assistance. Certainly a part of the defense may be that the patient was not properly informed previously that they were eligible or might be eligible for assistance. So that's probably where one would begin. The amount of the bill, unless there's clear information that it has been calculated in conformance with federal law. And one tip, although you can call your local legal aid program, one quick way to see whether you're getting overbilled or not is the state of Virginia, the Department of Medical Assistance Services, actually here in the Richmond office, has a reimbursement rate set for each hospital each year. So you can do a rough calculation fairly easily of what a Medicaid bill would be for a hospital procedure. And if you're being billed substantially more than the Medicaid rate, which is what every hospital will try to do if it can get away with, that's going to be a quick tip off that there is not compliance with federal law. And you'll know that you've been overbilled by the hospital.
So the patient should go to court, should present all of this to the judge, and essentially make the hospital prove otherwise.
That's correct. The most important thing to do, which is sadly what most people don't do, is to show up in court. Most lawsuits on hospital bills, until you get to much more substantial bills, are brought in the general district court. And this year, the legislature raised the amount of the claims which could be brought in general district court. They're now, as of last month, July, they've been increased to 25,000. So most hospital bills, except there were very, very large bills, will be brought in general district court. And in general district court, the first date to appear in courts is a physical appearance. The court functions because about 80% or more of people don't bother to show up in court. Just showing up in court can make the difference in potentially winning a case. Now, there's more to tell about how to assert defenses, what to do, but the most important thing to do is simply to show up in court. And sadly, that's what most people, assuming they may owe the bill when in fact they don't bother to do.
Thank you very much. We have been talking with Peyton Whiteley. He is the Advocacy Coordinator for Legal Services of Northern Virginia, and we have been talking about defenses to hospital collection bills and lawsuits. Thanks so much for being on the show, Peyton.
Glad to be here, Marty.
This week's Strange But True Law is from Title 24.2, which deals with elections. Code of Virginia Section 24.2-1005.1 makes it unlawful for any person to communicate to a registered voter by any means false information, knowing the same to be false, intended to impede the voter in the exercise of his right to vote. However, the section goes on to state that it applies only to information about the date, time, and place of the election or the voter's precinct, polling place, or voter registration status. Thank goodness. Otherwise, every politician who ran a campaign advertisement against his or her opponent would be guilty of a Class 1 misdemeanor. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King, and that's this week's Strange But True Law.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid radio show ever broadcast is now available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. You have the legal right to get into that public place, no matter what disability you may have. Join us next week when Jonathan Martinez, managing attorney at the Virginia Office for Protection and Advocacy, describes the laws that protect people with disabilities against discrimination in public accommodations and public access in a rebroadcast of a show originally heard on February 17, 2010. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegner.
My Lord.